This works, right?
Yeah.
So this is going to be experimental in multiple aspects. Like, normally I don't have people drawing unicorns on blackboards before giving a presentation. But since it's given part of the discussion that we had this morning, I thought it was actually relevant to involve you in part of this discussion. So I'm not going to disclose what the unicorns are good for right now, but I'll explain it later, okay? Also, at a certain point, I'll ask you to get your input. So please have your laptop or your smartphone ready, and I hope that you all have an internet connection, because I'll do some polls in between. But what I want to start off with is, do you know what this is? A book, yes. So whom of you has been using a book for research in the last week? Yeah, for research. So like not a roman, not a novel, but for research. Like who's come to a library to study in a book? Okay, and then in the last month? And then the last year? Are the people among you who have not touched a book for research purposes in the last year? Right. So science is changing quite a bit. Where, in the old days, it was very common to go to a library to borrow a book and to study the book from begin to end. Nowadays, science is really done differently. And that's what I want to focus on in this lecture, is like how is science changing and how should our strategies that we're using to do science, how should they change along with the way that science is changing? And I have a disclaimer, like a personal disclaimer to make. I started using Linux in around 94. And it's like, at that time, Linux was really in its infancy and it was distributed on floppy disks. So I basically went to the university with a stack of floppy disks. I put them in the computer, like, because at home I didn't have internet. Like, stuff like that wasn't really common. So basically went to the computer and then stuck floppy disks in the computer, downloading all the stuff, taking all the floppy disks home and installing Linux on my own computer. So as such, I'm a little bit biased towards using new technology. As Sam mentioned, I've also been developing FieldChip as an EEG and MEG processing toolbox, and I've been sharing it since, like, around 2004 when the Donners Center started in Nijmegen. And I've been organizing MEG EEG training events in Nijmegen since 2005. And actually for quite a few of them, I've been sharing the lectures on YouTube. Over the last few years, I'm getting more and more involved in defining international standards for MEG, for EEG, for intracranial EEG. Right now I'm quite busy with setting up the Donners data repository, which is about sharing data. And I'm involved in BITS, the brain imaging data standard, which is a way of organizing data which subsequently can be shared as open access. So these are all things that are like that have biased my own idea on how science is to be done. And I've been involved in open science already for a long time. But I want to start off with, like, what is open science? For me, open science has to do with open educational resources. And open science is also like moving away from these things. For example, to Wikipedia to look up stuff, or to look up open access journals, to look at open access courses, just use the internet for educating yourself. Open science is also about open access publications, like using publishing yourself open access, but also using open access publications to learn from other stuff. When I was doing a PhD, so that was around 2000, not all papers were available online. And I remember that I actually had to send people letters to send me a copy, like a paper copy of their journal, which was interesting. Or you could sometimes find a fax number and you could send them a fax and you would get a faxed paper back from them. If you now think of how internet has changed the way that we can access scholarly information, it's really, really very different now. Like, we more or less expect everything to be open access. And if it's not open access, you just go to ResearchGate and you ask the author of the paper whether he can send you a copy. Something that I as a physicist are quite keen on is open methodology. So I'm spending a lot of time on open source. Fieldtrip is an example of that, but I have other open source projects as well. And I'm actually also, like, I like to tinker. So open hardware, hardware that you can modify yourself, is, I also find it quite interesting. But I also consider it quite relevant for how science is progressing. That's also in like in a project that I'm doing with Simon. We're just using an existing piece of hardware, and we're seeing how can we integrate this into the scientific workflow for scanning electrodes, doing a very quick optical scan of electrodes on the subject's head. And finally, I think open data is really going to change the way that we do science. Now, open data is, for example, the Human Connectome Project that I got involved in some 10 years ago, in which we shared a very large data set. I learned a lot from that. But now at the Donders, we also have our Donders data repository, and the university is making it mandatory that we do proper data management, and our funding agencies are making it mandatory that where possible that we also share our research data, which is in line with what the publisher are also expecting from us. So, what is open science? Open science touches upon, so this is like a research cycle. And I know you're all like in, I think in the third year of your PhD project, like close to the end of the third year. So you've all at least experienced this whole research cycle once. You might still be working on the process of submitting, but you've gone through the research cycle. You probably started your second project, or perhaps some of you already your third project. The idea is that you start with an idea, then you try to come up with a solution. So you start with a question. How would this work? And then you come up with an idea, like how could I answer this question? So that's the discovery. Then you have to compile evidence for that. So you gather and you analyze. And then you start thinking about writing and publishing and then sharing. So this is all part of science. And open science touches upon each of these aspects that's part of the research cycle. So why would we care about open science if we think about the research cycle? And this is where I want you to help along. So can you go to this website and can you type this code? Okay, so the first question is an easy one. Are you all set? Yes, one person. Two. This is the very first time I'm using this. I just wanted to make sure that it actually works. Otherwise, like the first line, I'm already getting difficulty. Actually, it's also a nice way to get a feeling for how many people are participating. Okay, so. So this is not really an important question. What I will do, I will move on to the next question, which is a question that I would like you to answer like more seriously. Let's see. Oh, why is this so large? And you can't see the answer. Oh, here it is. Okay, so if I'm correct, you should now see it on your computer screen. You should see the options that you can answer. So please... You can't really see it here at the bottom. Like the resolution is too crappy. But could you answer like why is open science? Why do you think that open science is important? The first answer: everyone should have access to research results. Collaboration makes research more efficient. Research results in better research tools. It engages the public in research. Or it. What's the last one again? It allows for better assessment of research results, I think. Let me actually also go there myself, okay? I can't read them there. Okay, so I think that by now... probably most of you have answered, and it's quite clear that most of you think that everyone should have access to results. Also, quite some of you say collaboration makes research more effective. Actually, I'm a little bit surprised of this not getting any answers. Like, it is something that we discussed before, also at previous events, like engaging the audience, the public in research is, of course, also important. But, of course, I know that I've only been giving you the possibility to answer one of them. So what this shows is that there's multiple reasons why open science is important. Let's see. Yes, I don't have the mirroring here. Let's see this, whether this works. No. Does anyone of you see my mouse? No. Let's quickly abort. So why do open science? Well, it's democratic. Science should be accessible for all. That's what you agree to. There's pragmatic motivation for doing open science. If you do open science, it's just easy to collaborate. Open science has impact on infrastructure. If we invest in open science, we're investing in creating better tools, and those tools make science in general better. Public. Science should be disseminated to the wide public. Like, we're being funded by the wide public, and the results, we're trying to make them relevant for society, so therefore society should know about it. And it also changes the way that we are evaluated ourselves. Like, with open science, the way that our results or our efficiency as being a researcher can be evaluated in different ways. For example, using altimetric scores rather than using an H-index. So these are five important motivations for open science. And this morning, these have already been discussed by Adrian in the talk this morning, like as the different schools of thought why open science is important. And they're not necessarily opposing, they're just different motivations. There's another reason that I see in why open science is important, and that's actually not such a positive motivation. That's basically that in society, there's also a lack of trust in us researchers. So this is a cartoon from, it's a Dutch cartoon. It's about Stapel. Stapel was a social psychologist, and he fabricated about half of his papers, sorry, the data for half of his papers. He was like really a famous psychologist, like often interviewed in newspapers. At some point, he became the dean of the faculty. He had like a lot of multiple Nature and Science papers. And they all had to be retracted because he fabricated his results. Of course, another example of lack of trust in society is this guy, who's really making very, for me, very not understandable claims about science. So, and that's what I see as a problem, and that's why I think that open science, like being more open on how we do science, is necessary and is important to engage the public in the way that we do science, to prevent these type of things, like lack of trust in society. A second and very closely related thing is lack of trust among scientists themselves. I think a lot of you know about, among others, this paper. So this is something that appeared in Science a few years ago, in which the authors, a very long list of authors, replicated 100 studies from psychology. And so these were all papers that had been published. And what turned out is that along the horizontal axis, is the original effect size, along the vertical axis is the replicated effect size. So what you would, of course, expect is that the reported effect size, that you can replicate that. But what turned out is that a lot of the published findings, they could actually not be reproduced. So if you look at the distribution of the non-replicated findings, they basically show no effect size. So 40% of the papers could not be reproduced at all. And quite a significant fraction of the papers, when they were reproduced, resulted in an effect size that was smaller than the one originally reported. I think this is also really an important aspect of us changing the way that we do science. Because if this is the way that we would be, like, continue to work, then we're going to build science on, like, on quicksand, like on a very unstable foundation, and we'll also be contributing to creating only more quicksand. And I think we should ensure that science remains, like, very stable, that we can trust upon the findings of previous people, and open science will help us in achieving that goal. Okay, let's return to the cycle of to this research cycle. So, at what moment is open science relevant? As soon as you're thinking and planning your science, your scientific project, of course, it's already relevant. At that moment, you're accessing open resources. You're using Wikipedia. You're using open scholarly publications. If you discover, that's where you have open discussions. That's where you discuss not only with your lab mates, but it's also where you might want to discuss, like at a conference. Like conferences are very important, like engaging with, or workshops like this are very important, in engaging with people from your research field. And being comfortable in discussing with people in your research field, that also has to do with openness. If you're gathering and analyzing your data, you might have access to open, you might be able to access existing data, like either existing data from previous PhD students in your lab or data that you've downloaded from the internet, such as the Human Connectome Project data. And very often you would also be using open methods. So a lot of, I've been developing FieldTrip, which is used by quite some of you here in the audience from the Child Brain Project at least. But you might also be using R, you might be using Python. There's many open source methods that are nowadays being used in research. And if you're writing and if you're publishing, you're also doing open science because you're more and more working in a collaborative nature where the publication is going to be open access, but also the writing process is going to be more open than how it used to be. And of course, at the sharing and at the impact, it's quite obvious how openness is contributing there. So academia has changed a lot. Like this is a photo of a library. This is where you could borrow books. I never go to libraries anymore. If I need a book, I might order it online on Amazon or so. But actually, what I'm primarily relying on is open access publications. I'm using open resources, and I realize that having the internet really changed science. So rather than using typewriters and using really old-fashioned computing devices, we're now using a very different set of tools. And I think these tools already reflect part of the open science. So open science is not so much, it's really changing the way that we use tools. And the internet is one of these things that was developed to open up science. Like, internet was developed at the CERN by scientists so that they could share their work, so they can discuss, collaborate, etc. I think that, so the impact of internet on, or at least the impact of the World Wide Web on science is because the World Wide Web came out of science, came out of a science need. So what I want you to do is to go to menti.com and to answer the next question. I'll try to get it up here as well. The thing with this screen is really... Screen sharing thing doesn't really work as well. So why is this not showing? It's down here. Sorry about this. I should have tested this. I'll do it like this. Okay, I think you should now have a new question. So what tools are you using in science for writing? Pen and paper, typewriter, MS Office, MS Word or OpenOffice, LaTeX, Google Docs, or other. So we now have some 30 answers. I think this is already giving the idea on the tools that are being used, like pen and paper is used a lot. A lot of you are using Word. I'm also using Word myself. I'm telling my students to use Word. What I especially like about Word is that it has a revision control. So you basically can, I can type comments that my students, that they can actually see the comments that I've been typing. That's what I don't like about LaTeX. I did my own thesis in LaTeX. It was really difficult to work together with my supervisor. He always asked me to print it with a double line spacing, and then he would write in between. So, and yeah, like just creating stacks of paper, and I had to read it and I had to type it all over. Also, quite a lot of you are using Google Docs, and within ChildBrain, we've been using Google Docs since about a year or so into the project. Also to make notes. So I suspect that some of you are at this moment actually using Google Docs to make notes jointly. At least that's what I saw people doing this morning, because I just went to the Google Drive and I saw some people like taking shared notes of the previous two presentations. So Google Docs is really about collaborating on documents. So the tools that we use for writing, they really influence the way that we can collaborate. Like with pen and paper, it's easy to create, to make drawings, to think about yourself, but it's much more difficult to collaborate with pen and paper than it is with MS Word or even with Google Docs. And I think that's an important consideration, is that science is, or open science is also about the tools that we're using, and the tools that we're using are changing. And that's what I want to focus on a little bit, like on infrastructure and tools used in science. Like a tool that I use a lot, but I want to get away of is email. People send me a lot of emails. I also send a lot of other people emails. And if I think about my emails, I realize how difficult it is to keep track of all these emails that I'm getting. If I think about email attachments, it's even more difficult. It might be that if I'm collaborating with someone in the ChildBrain network, that a student is working on the paper, he sent me a version, sent me a new version. And then in my email program, at a certain point, when I find the time to work on the paper, I actually have to find the latest version, and I have to start typing, and then basically have to email it back. So it's a lot of email attachment being bounced back and bounced forth. A tool that I'm now exploring is Slack, which is like a messaging thing, like a messaging service for teams, for collaboration. But I realize that Slack is not really for documentation. Slack is just for the messaging. So basically, also email is not for documentation. But the way that I'm using my email is basically documentation, because I just leave my attachments in my email. I'm not storing all my attachments in separate files. Google Docs is, of course, designed with the idea that you would jointly work on a document. So what I really prefer is if people send me a link to a Google Doc, because then a few days later when I click on the link, then I know that all the changes that the person has been making or that other people have been making are directly reflected in the version that I'm looking at. Related to this is, of course, collaborative sense, is also that Skype or TeamViewer or VNC, they're all methods for collaborate, for real-time instant collaboration. They're not so much for communication, but it's actually being able to look at each other's screen and being able to point out details in figures that we're discussing, sometimes even to take over the keyboard so that I can type something like in MATLAB or so, that I can show how to do a certain analysis. And that's really based on the tools that we're using. So open science really has a very strong dependency on these tools. And one of these tools is called Git. And Git comes with, Git is a version control system. It's a piece of software. It was designed for the Linux kernel, to manage the Linux kernel, because the Linux kernel is a very large project that involves a lot of different people from all over the world that have to collaborate. So Git is a version control system designed for collaboration. And on top of Git, other services came into existence, such as GitHub. Whom of you knows GitHub? Okay, good. So some of you are not raising your hand. So GitHub is a website where you can collaborate on code. And the way that the website has been built is really about that the social aspect of collaboration, that's the more important thing on GitHub. So it's not a very technical website, but although the technology underneath can be quite overwhelming. The Open Science Framework was already mentioned this morning. So that's osf.io. The Open Science Framework is also a website where you can work together on a scientific project. And it does much more than just controlling code. It's also about controlling documentation. It's about making your lab notes, like working real time with lab notes with other people, but it's also about sharing your publications. So you can link your Mendeley account to OSF so that all the people that are working together on one Open Science Framework project, they all have access to the same publications. And it might also be that you're jointly reading a publication and then decide that you're not going to use it for your paper because it wasn't relevant at all. But it allows for doing these type of things. And GitHub now exists for almost 10 years. OSF exists for a few years. Something that I recently became aware of is called CodeOcean. CodeOcean is a cloud-based computational reproducibility platform. It's a place where you can go, not only share your code, but actually you can run your code. So what you see happening is that websites are being developed. Google Doc is, of course, a website. Websites are being developed that really influence the way that we work. So whereas at this moment you still might be working on your local computer to do your computations, a lot of you have already switched to the internet for the collaborative writing. And it might very well be that in a few years from now, you're also going to move to a collaborative website for analyzing. So what we have is notebooks. This is old-fashioned notebooks where you would take notes. But what we might have in the future is notebooks that are actually much more lively, that the whole process of doing science is going to be done using tools that allow you to collaborate in real time with people elsewhere. So if you think about the past, the present, and the future, so in the past we would have black and white versions of an article on paper, which you could tuck in an envelope, you could send it to someone. The present is that we have PDF versions of documents that you can download, that you can access, that you can search online. And the future might very well be that we have open access notebooks with direct interaction in them. I won't show you one, but it's too elaborative at the moment. But the idea is, I think you can imagine, the jump from a typewriter to Google Docs. You could also imagine, how is that going to change the way that we do our analysis? Okay, again, a Mentimeter question. Have you shared your research? Have you made open access publications? Have you shared your presentation, for example, on FigShare or on SlideShare? Have you shared videos? Have you shared data on Zenodo or on OSF? Have you shared code, for example, on GitHub? Have you posted on Facebook? Have you posted on Twitter? Or perhaps something that's not mentioned here? So a lot of you have already published open access publications, papers. That's cool. Also, a lot of you have presentations on FigShare. But it's actually interesting to see that all of the other categories are also being mentioned. Just out of my curiosity, so multiple people have indicated that you're doing something else in terms of sharing your research. Would anyone want to share like what you've done to share your research? Yeah, so sharing your slides, like for example, sending someone a PDF or the PowerPoint slides. So that's already, of course, opening up things. Yeah. Sorry, what?
Like the preprint.
Oh, putting stuff on the preprint server, like BioArchive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyone else wants to also share ideas on how you can share ideas with this audience and how you can do open science? Yeah, that's a good one. Yes, making posters actually count beyond the moment at which you're presenting them, but allowing people to contact you on the poster, or of course also hand out on posters, or having like a QR code on your poster that people can quickly download a copy of your poster. Yeah, very valuable. Yeah. Okay, so, but the thing is, if you share your science, or if you share the results of your science, it often does involve a little bit of planning ahead. You have to plan your, science in general is about planning. Like, you just don't get into it. Like, you plan your analysis. You plan and then you publish your primary outcomes. So you write your scientific papers, you write your PhD thesis, and you do public outreach. And this is something that we're primarily going to touch upon, that you're primarily going to touch upon tomorrow morning, but it has already been discussed also before the lunch break this morning. Something that I want to explain a little bit more is like planning and publishing secondary outcomes, like the things that you might not necessarily think about as the results of your science, which would, for example, be like planning your data management plan, like how are you going to deal with your data, or how are you going to deal with the details on the method, like publishing your analysis methods. That's also where planning ahead comes in. And I will quickly try whether I can get the screen resolution better, because this is actually quite crappy because you can't read it. Now it is slightly better, right? It's still difficult to read. It's stupid. I think I'll just read it. So this is a schematic to think about publication. It's called the IMRAD, Introduction, Methods, Results, and Discussion. It's basically the standard style that you will see for scientific publication. An introduction deals with like what's the context for the project, how does it fit with all the research on the topic, what is the research question. So that's about the why. Methods, what did the authors do to answer the research question? That's about the how. The results, what was the answer to the question? So what did the methods result in? And this is often shown in tables and figures, so that's about the what. And a discussion and a conclusion is about like what's the significance of the project and how does it fit in with what else is known about the topic. So that's about the relevance, the so what. And if you think about publication with the primary findings, then often they will follow this structure. On the one hand, they have a wider audience. On the other hand, they have scientific, like your scientific peers, the people in your field. And if you think of this sandwich, like the further away that the audience is from you as an expert on your own small research field, the more it's at the top and at the bottom. So if you think about the general, like the public audience, they would primarily care about the why and the so what. So that's what you would think about if you would do like a press release. The press release would only call, would only say why, a little bit on the what, and then the so what, like societal relevance. Of course, the closer you get to communicating with your scientific peers, the more important it becomes to go to this middle section. Because your scientific peers will know why it is relevant, like they work in the same field. Of course, they are interested in like the findings that you have, so they're interested about the results, but they will also be interested in the methods. So for in open science, it's really important to think about the different audiences that you're addressing. And besides your primary findings, you have your methods, you have your protocol, you have your stimulus material, you have your analysis methods, and then you collect your data, and then you have your results. And in open science, you should not only care about sharing a publication with the primary findings, but you should also care about sharing these, because that will actually help you to collaborate with people in your own research field, or possibly people in other research fields. So it's again a Mentimeter question. I have to close it here. Okay, have you used any of these tools in doing science? Have you used open access publications? Have you used presentations on Figshare? Have you shared data on Zenodo or OSF? Have you shared code? Have you used open access publications? Have you used presentation? Have you used videos? Have you shared data? Have you shared code? Sorry? I would count it as an open access publication, yes. So a lot of you are using open science in your own research process. And actually, it's so that what you might realize, it's the same set of answers as in the previous slide. Because on the one hand, you're able to contribute to open science yourself. On the other hand, you're also depending on open science in order to get your research done. And the only way that you can use all of these is if we, as the scientific community, contribute to open science. And so I'm trying to contribute over the whole range. I'm better at certain fields than others. I'm not really that good at Twitter, so like I feel very uncomfortable if I have to compress everything in such a short post. But there's definitely some of these that I feel quite comfortable with. I'm also happy to see that a lot of you have used it, but also have contributed to it. Again, for the others, like what other open science things have you used that are not listed here? Does anyone want to share? The six people that have clicked that button. The answers are anonymous, so I can't force you to give the answer.
maybe you have a shared drive that you share with all the colleagues at the same time, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So you upload the data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was actually interesting. Like this also touches upon something that was already mentioned earlier, is that open science, you can actually think of it at different levels of openness. Like open science, on the one hand, you have open science open to everyone, but then you also have open science like to your lab mates or to the people within your project, like in an EU project. But I think that the strategies that you use are very similar. Like if you know how to share a drive with your lab mates, then you can also know how to share it with people outside of your lab. Although there might be other concerns, of course, once you start sharing outside of your lab, because all of a sudden privacy issues might come at hand. Okay, so as I said, open science is largely science in general. Is largely about planning ahead. And if you want to do open science, you definitely have to think about certain things that you want to plan ahead. And what I want to focus on in the remainder of the lecture is on planning or analysis, and it's on planning and publishing secondary outcomes. Because like the planning on how to write your primary outcomes, I think that's obvious for you. At least by now that's obvious that that should be publicly accessible. And also the whole structure, like it's not really my expertise, but that's what we'll discuss tomorrow, like how to write your thesis. So let's look at the analysis plan. A lot of you will have an analysis plan. It gets really interesting if you make a pre-analysis plan out of it. A pre-analysis plan is something where you write down what you plan to do prior to doing it. And I know that that's difficult, because science is often about there's a discovery aspect to it. But a pre-analysis plan is very relevant if you consider the lack of trust and the lack of reproducibility that we see in science, like among scientists ourselves. So the idea of a pre-analysis plan is that you share your a priori hypothesis and that you share the choices that you're going to make in your analysis. And this contributes to preventing p-hacking and harking. P-hacking is repeatedly testing without actually telling so. So p-hacking is, for example, stop collecting, like you collect data until you have significant finding. If that's your strategy, then you're p-hacking. Because due to randomness in your data, you're always going to encounter a moment at which your finding is significant. It might take a long time, but if that's the moment that you're going to stop, you're not controlling for false alarms. So your report is probably not going to be reproduced by anyone else. P-hacking is also well known, like if you analyze many measures but only report those ones where you have significance. So just do 20 tests and one of them is going to be significant, right? Because you have a chance of 5% of making errors. Of course, it's like statistically going to be slightly different. But given the complexity of the data that we're analyzing nowadays, the chance of multiple comparisons are a serious problem, and the chance of having false alarms is therefore also a serious concern. Analyzing, doing a lot of different analysis, and not reporting which one you've been analyzing, that's really a serious concern. And that's where stating your hypothesis a priori is really important. Or collecting and analyzing many conditions, but only report the ones that are significant. Or if it's not significant, see whether it gets significant if you start adding a covariate. So it's not significant. Well, perhaps it's significant if I use gender as a covariate, or if I use age as a covariate, or if I use some other random variable as a covariate. Exclude participants, like exclude the outlier participants so that it becomes significant. It's fine if you exclude participants, but not to obtain significance. It might be that you want to exclude participants because they did not do the task properly, but not because you don't like the data that you collected from them. Or to first do an analysis and then to transform the data and to see whether that transformation, like whether you're log transforming or doing some other sort of transformation, whether that makes the result significant. These are all things that if you torture the data long enough, they will confess. And this is a serious problem in science. Like a lot of people will have incentives to engage in these types of activities. And these incentives are that you have to publish. You have to have results in order to get to your next position. The second one is harking. Harking stands for hypothesizing after results are known. So the idea is you collect data, you analyze it, and then there's an interesting pattern there. An interesting pattern is significant if you test it, and then you come up with hypothesis. So what could this mean? So a harking is about presenting an a post hoc hypothesis, one that's based on the data, based or informed by the one's results, in one's research report as if it were, in fact, an a priori hypothesis. And that's also, again, why it's important to state the a priori hypothesis in your pre-analysis plan and then to stick to it. But, of course, that's not how science works, because sometimes there are unexpected findings, and if you can't report these unexpected findings, we would not be making progress. The idea of a pre-analysis... Yeah, sorry.
Is there a relationship with the exploratory?
Yeah, so if your plan is to explore, that's something that you can write down. And explorative studies, and there's nothing wrong with explorative studies, except that there seems to be this this convention in science that science is only relevant if you can attach a p-value to it, right? So that's why a lot of people have this tendency, like, let's first do a p-value and then we can start thinking about publishing it. And I think that's something that we should get away from. I think a lot of the studies actually that are being published are actually more exploratory. That's also something that should be acknowledged as being valuable. So the idea of pre-registering your analysis plan is that you write down what you plan to do, and then you submit it. A place where you can submit it is, for example, aspredicted.org. It's a website. You just go there, you type what you plan, and then you submit, and then you get a code. And at the moment, and your plan gets a timestamp. And at the moment that you publish your paper, you can refer to a URL which is hidden up to the moment that you decide to disclose it. And on that URL, people can see the timestamped a priori analysis plan. And if you choose not to disclose the pre-analysis plan, that's also fine. Like, you're not forced to disclose it, but it's your choice. And of course, it will make your findings stronger if you submit your pre-analysis plan, and if you can say, I followed my pre-analysis plan, and these are my findings, and therefore I have done my research properly.
Yeah, sorry, maybe I should know this one. Up to which point you can pre-register and study? Because that's also, you're still collecting and you can still pre-register during the collection.
If
you shouldn't.
I think if during collection, if you already start realizing certain patterns that change your analysis plan, then it's too late. Because you might, for example, see that your subjects are not, that the subjects that you're collecting from, that they're not performing the task properly. So you might start thinking about, oh, let's do another analysis because the task is not working.
Yeah, that's what should be done, but yeah. It
would
still work officially.
I there's no such thing as official. Like, it's like we as scientists among ourselves, we decide how to do things, like also the 5% rule for significance. That's not an official rule. That's something that we decide ourselves. Ideally, you would want to pre-register before you start data acquisition.
Yeah.
Because ideally, you want to have your plan finished before you start executing your plan.
But that's not something you really control, right? They're not something that's checked.
Pre-registration is not checked.
Yeah.
Unless in certain cases, like clinicaltrials.gov. Some clinical trials, they require you. You are not allowed to start from the ethical committee if you have not registered your plan yet. So hopefully we're not going to get that strict in general science. Hopefully that's not necessary, but it also depends on how we behave.
Doesn't a few journals actually have this pre-registration?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's actually interesting, because like pre-registration already exists for quite some time, and now journals or publishers are embracing the idea of pre-registration, and sometimes you can even get a free ticket into the journal if you pre-register. That's cool. Like, just like saying, this is what I'm going to do, this is how I'm going to do it, and the journal is going to guarantee you that you can publish. I think that's really a very interesting development, to see how these things about open science and planning, how they're changing the way that science gets done, and how they're changing the way that the journals also facilitate science. Yes. Yes. And that's also why I think that so for the outlet through which we should publish null filings, that's still a little bit undefined. But I think that, for example, the EU, but also other funding agencies, are making it very clear that we should be publishing our data. so that at least that part of the work that we have done gets published. And of course, if you then describe how the data was collected, and then you might also want to describe what you have done with the data without getting any relevant results out of it, that might already be relevant for other people that want to build on that. Like they might want to cross-validate whether your data indeed confirms them also not finding it. So I think from the funding agencies, that's where I expect the strongest push for us, like pre-registering, but also simply publishing negative findings. Because like a lot of science is designed to fail. If all science would work, then we would not be very ambitious. I think the whole point of doing science is that we're ambitious. We want to discover things that we don't know yet. And of course, we have to take risks. So therefore, we should fail. And I think it's important to show these failures. But of course, there is this situation like, what if things don't go as predicted? But that's not so much a problem as long as you're honest. So you can just say so in a paper. So you can say, this is what I plan to do. But contrary to expectations, we found that, and you describe what you found. Or you can say, unexpectedly, we also found that. Or in addition to the analysis we pre-registered, we saw an interesting pattern, and therefore we also did this exploratory analysis. Or we encountered an unexpected situation and followed our standard operating procedures. And that is like the standard operating procedures that I'm mentioning here. That's an important thing that you should also think about, like because the pre-registration plan, you don't necessarily want to write everything that you might be doing in the next year in your pre-registration. A lot of the things that you're going to do during your research are probably the same things that your colleagues are going to do. Like how are you going to decide whether a subject is to be rejected from the analysis, or how are you going to decide on certain analytical choices? Probably the same way as your colleagues are doing it as well. So I think it's really valuable that within labs and within research groups, standard operating procedures are developed, also are being shared, that describe how to deal with unexpected situations. And then everything that is basically written down, if you just publish, if you put them on GitHub, for example, I know some really good examples on GitHub, standard operating procedures, and then you can just refer to them, and then you can say, this is my plan, and if it doesn't go as expected, I will follow this plan, and if it then still doesn't go as expected, you'll just say so. So pre-registration is very much about honesty, but it's not about not being able to publish. It's about making it more aware what are the a priori hypotheses versus what are the a posteriori hypothesis. Like what are the things that you have explored, that you have found using exploratory analysis, and that you have interesting hypotheses about that are to be tested in a future study. Because that's also what science is about. It's also about creating new hypotheses. And I think that's something that we should value more. It's like more the hypothesizing aspect in the discussion section rather than trying to squeeze all the hypotheses in introduction. So this is what I had to about pre-registration. Any further questions about this? Pavel. I think you can actually consider this at multiple stages because your project proposal that you're submitting in order to get a grant, it is already a sort of a pre-registration because you are already writing down what you plan to do. Of course, the problem with a project proposal is that besides the reviewers that decide on whether you get the money or not, no one is ever going to see it. Because usually there's like... sensitive information for your competitors, so usually people don't share the project proposals. At the Donner Center in Nijmegen, we don't share project proposals either, but we have a project proposal meeting. So at the level that people want to actually run the experiment, so that's usually when a PhD student starts, then a PhD student has to present in front of the center. Like it's an open meeting, the whole center can attend. And they get 15 minutes time to plan their project, or sort of to present a planned project. That plays a formal role because, like, we have expensive scanners. We're doing a lot of neural imaging, so we have MEG, fMRI, and we want to ensure, like as a center, we want to ensure that those scanners are being used for good research. So we require people to pre-register the research to present it, and if we consider it good enough, then people can use it. But the nice thing about the project proposal meetings is that the slides are also shared. So we can look up the slides, even a few years later, we can still look up the slides of what was actually planned in this study and what was actually reported in the paper some years later. So within the DCCN, although we never really thought about it in the sense of a project of a pre-registration, I think the way that we do our project proposal meetings, and especially the way that we make the slides that are presented at a project proposal meeting, make them accessible to other researchers in the center, that's already sort of a pre-registration. I think if you really want to impact science at large, then you should do the pre-registration outside of your own research group or outside your own center. So I think then you should really start thinking about depositing your research plan on external registration sites such as aspredicta.org. But I think if the research plan is not very concrete, the chances are that you are increasingly large that you have to deviate from it. So that's why it doesn't really make sense to, in the first year of your PhD project, to pre-register what you're going to do in the fourth year. Like, that's going to change anyway. Yes, I think the role for discovery science should be reevaluated. I think we're doing a lot of discoveries that need to be valued more. I think a lot of discoveries are now being hidden in papers and are sold as if they are a priori findings, although in reality they're just discoveries, and I think discoveries are great. Okay, so another thing that I want to focus on is on the data management plan. How many of you have written a data management plan? That's not a lot. Actually, the first time that I had to write a data management plan was within ChildBrain, and I really had this impression that we have to write something for the security officer of the university. I didn't even know that the university had such a person. And then we had to submit this, and then it got a stamp on it, and it was approved. But actually, that's not how I think that a data management plan, that's not the relevance of a data management plan. I think the relevance of a data management plan is that you, for yourself and for the people around you, that you write down what is the data that you will collect, and how are you going to document this data? Like, where are you going to store it, but also how are you going to describe the data so that you can, like, maximize the value of the data? And that's because you want to learn, you want to use data that has been collected by others, so you hope that other people have written the data management plan and that they have documented it. So a lot of researchers, they start with data that has been collected by people that have previously been working in a lab to learn the analysis, to use as for a pilot, to estimate like effect size, but also sometimes for reanalysis or for doing new analysis on existing data. And that's also where the reciprocity comes in. Like, if you use data that has been provided by other people, then you should also be aware of, like, what is it that you need in that data. You need it to be properly documented. So that's also why you should care about documentation, because you want to share your data, and you will also want your data to contribute to your successors in the lab. Your successors are going to be very thankful for that, and if you're lucky, then you're going to get a co-authorship. And you didn't even have to do that much for it, because you basically just shared them the data, shared them some ideas, and then the next generation of PhD students are going to do the work. So very efficient. So the idea is that you document the details of your data, for example, in a code book in which you describe like what does each of the columns in my table mean. And I think very important is that if you want to reuse your own data, which you often want, you really have to document it. If you think about a scientific process, the data is often collected at a moment that's quite far from, but that's in time quite far from the moment at which you're going to analyze it. So at a certain point, you might stand there and like be totally puzzled, like, so what was it again in this data? There was something with it, but I forgot to write it down. Or I wrote it down on a piece of paper, and I don't know where I left the piece of paper. So data management plan, I think if you primarily consider your future self, then you will also be considering your future colleagues and other people that in the future might need your data. And so I think that's how you should primarily think about making a data management plan. Like just document the data for your future self. In open data, which is like the next step, if you have collected data, then you can start thinking about like how do I make this data accessible for other people? The acronym FAIR is really important. FAIR stands for findable. So data and supplementary materials have sufficient rich, should have sufficient rich metadata and unique and persistent identifier. Like you should know what goes together and should be able to point to it. Like this hard disk has this data. Accessible. Data should be deposited in a trusted repository, and authentication and authorization procedures are necessary. Now, such a hard disk that's like a USB hard disk on your desk, that's not very accessible. At the Donors, we have used we've used USB hard disks for archiving for a long time. And at a certain point, we started counting how many of these hard disks were still in the building. And it turned out that a lot of PhD students had taken hard disks home with them. Makes sense. That's also what I did when I was a PhD student. Because you just want to safeguard your data. But that means that the data cannot be used anymore in the future. So from the 1,000 hard disks or so that we have been filling over the years, a significant fraction, I think at least one-third or so, simply disappeared. Like no one knows where they are. So that's why it is important, like at a university scale, to think about like where can you make the data available for future people that want people that want to use the data in the future. Data, yeah. I will come to this later, okay? Yeah, because it's a very important aspect. So here, so data should be deposited in a trusted repository. So it's like should, so there, it should be clear who can access it, and also if necessary, authentication or authorization procedure should be in place. So it is already. So here I'm already alluding, but I have another set of slides on that. But storing data for future use does not mean that you just post it somewhere on the internet. You have to think about like who can access this data in the future. Because it's a need, like the data that we're working with is, it can be sensitive. Another aspect of open access data, about properly managing your data, making your data fair. This is not only about open access because access might be restricted. Making your data fair is that the data has to be interoperable. So it means that the metadata and the data should use a formal, accessible, shared, and broadly applicable language or format. A little bit vague, but you can think of formats as if in 10 years from now, if someone else wants to use the data, can he still read the data? That's an important one. And that's, of course, where we've had, some 15 years ago, we had big discussions about Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel. Which were like formats that no one else could read. I still have my first written documents in Word Perfect. I can't read them anymore. Because like the file format is simply not supported anymore. I don't have a DOS computer anymore, so I can't read them. Microsoft has switched to the Open Document language, which is like a description that can also be implemented using other software, such as OpenOffice. I think that's what you should think about, like how do you make sure that the data is accessible in the future? And then, of course, the important thing is reusable. So data is described with clear and understandable attributes, but there should also be a clear and acceptable license for reuse. So that doesn't mean that everyone should be allowed to use it, but it should be clear under which conditions the data can be used. And that can, for example, be conditions about maintaining the privacy of the subject. So if you think about open science and open data, then shared data allows for improved reproducibility. It facilitates certain type of research, especially research where you need very large groups because it has very small effect sizes. Like either because the data is very noisy, because you have a lot of variance within a subject, or you have a lot of variance between subjects, like as we often have in studies that are involving children, where you basically want to accumulate data from where you might have to accumulate data from multiple sites, multiple centers, in order to be able to do a study. And shared data allows for data mining, for discovery science, and for generating new hypotheses. But shared data also allows for methodological opportunities. We can improve algorithms if we have data, like finding out which algorithms work, but also which ones don't work. Well, it requires that they have to be put at the test. And for a very long time, people that are working on algorithms have not really had their hands on data. So they were trying to sell algorithms without actually being able to show the validity of those algorithms. And now with shared data, we can actually show the value or the limited value of those algorithms. You can use shared data to estimate group sizes, effect sizes, which helps in planning a next study. Really important, so that you can actually have a scientific justification why you're going to include N children in your study, like estimating this N a priori. We can make informed decisions about the analysis pipeline that we're going to apply. And of course, shared data allows for better control on harking and on p-hacking. But since we're working with, like most of us are working with data from human participants, we have, of course, like ethical and legal requirements to think about. And quite interesting is that as of 1.5-2 weeks, the GDPR came into play, although it actually was formally already approved 2 years ago, but now it's actually really enforced. And the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, that's a EU-wide regulation which states that personal data needs to be protected. So that's quite a challenge for us using personal data in science. But it's also an opportunity. Because when we started with Child Brain Project, we were discussing primarily like how the different legislations, how they were different. So we were not really able to come up with a way of sharing data because in every country the rules were different. And now we have the opportunities that we have less influence of national laws, and we can learn from each other and we can develop best practices. So what I want to do is in the next few slides is I want to show like how we've developed our best practices at the donors, because I think that might be relevant for you. And of course the challenge here is that on the one hand we have the privacy, on the other hand we have the open data, and it's often a tug of war, and you have to balance the two properly. So the GDPR is on personal data. Personal data, that's data such as the name, the address, the date of birth, the phone number, an IP address might count as personal data, license plate number. It's basically anything that can be written down in a document such as a passport. And it's the things that if someone gets shot or stabbed or whatever, if the police arrives, the first thing that the police is going to search for is for personal data. They're going to see what they can find, a driver's license or a passport, because then they know who the victim is. Right? But as soon as the police realize that there's no passport or other personal data on the subject, they're going to look at biometric data. And biometric data is data which you can record from your subject, from your participant, from the victim, that in some cases allows you to identify the subject, such as the facial details, the dental records, the fingerprints, genetics. But if you look at MRI, you could also say that cortical folding patterns, like as the ones that you get with FreeSurfer, they're also like fingerprints. Clinical data, specific pattern of clinical data, the cortical responses, event-related potentials, if you present a stimulus, also responses to a questionnaire. These might all be pieces of data that you're collecting from your research participants, which might be able to identify an individual participant. So personal data comes in two forms. On the one hand, there's directly identifying personal data, which has these identifiers. And on the other hand, there's indirectly identifying personal data that, although it does not specify the identity, it doesn't specify the name, it would allow you to find the identity. Personal data is necessary for our research, and therefore you should plan for how to manage your personal data. We need our personal data for administration. So first of all, you have to invite your participants, which means that you have to have their email address or their phone number or something like that. You have to have the name, because otherwise it's difficult to communicate with them. We use personal data to pay our subjects. Like, your university prefers to pay them by putting the money on the bank account. But that doesn't mean that I need to have that type of personal data. That's only our university administration needs to have that. It might also be that you're using these vouchers to reimburse your participants. And of course, you don't need to have any information about their bank account details. At the donors, we also need personal data to follow up incidental findings. So we're doing a lot of imaging experiments. And in about 1 or 2 out of 100 participants, there are deviations on anatomical scans. At the Dons, we're scanning about 4,000 people a year. So that means that every week, or actually on average every week, or slightly more often, we have someone in our scanner where the anatomical MRI shows something that is deviant. So that's something that we have to deal with. Like, it would not be ethical to not tell the subject. It would also not be ethical if the researcher, the PhD student sitting at the scanner, doesn't know what to do with it. So what we have is we have a standard operating procedure. And the standard operating procedure describes how we deal with it. It involves the researcher not telling the subject directly. The researcher has to give the scans to our MR technician, who's going to have a look at it. If our technician thinks it's potentially serious, then we'll have a clinically trained doctor look at it. If the clinically trained doctor considers it serious, then the clinically trained doctor is going to send a letter to the home physician, to the general practitioner of the research subject, of the participant. So that's the procedure, and that letter is not going to be in much detail, because it's not a clinical scan, but the participant gets to know from his GP that an abnormality was seen and that he should contact his GP for further information to follow this up. So that's a procedure that we have in place, and we basically use it every week to deal with incidental findings. And of course, a lot of these incidental findings, a lot of these abnormalities are not clinically disturbing per se. Like, so it's not that all these people have some serious disease, but it's just something that needs to be looked into. But more important is that a lot of the personal data that we're recording is not required to address the research question. So you don't use names as a regressor in your experimental design. Sometimes you can use some parameters as a confound, like the gender or the age. Sometimes you have to use this to check whether the sample was representative, and possibly they're required to assess scientific integrity. But what's important is that this means that a lot of the personal data that we're acquiring is not really as relevant as we think it is. So that's why we should try to acquire it separately from all the research data, the data that we care about in the research project. So according to GDPR, each country has to have its own translation of the GDPR. Personal data includes name, address, date of birth, etc. And in the Netherlands, we have special personal data. And special personal data is data that is considered to be sensitive. The race, the religion or beliefs, the health situation, sexual activities, political preference, being a membership of a union, or your criminal record, they all are considered special personal data. And no one is allowed to collect the special personal data without permission from the representative government body. So this is stuff that we're usually not recording, except for health. And of course, for those cases where we record health we of course make sure that we have approval from the ethical committee. The data that we're mostly recording, that we're also mostly interested in, is indirect personal data. And indirect personal data is data that allows you to identify a person if you were to link that data to an external database. And for me, like, the most obvious example is a fingerprint. Like, a fingerprint is not identifying, but if you leave your fingerprint on a crime scene, and the police will be able to find that fingerprint in their database, and then you're linked. And then they have identified you. So fingerprints, DNA, facial details, like if you think of like this new iPhone, it scans your face and then unlocks. Well, that's biometric data. It allows your iPhone to identify that it's you. Anatomical MRI, but also specific patterns of data. So you have specific questions on a specific answers on a questionnaire. They would all possibly be able to link a subject to another database. So if I were to do an IQ test, if I have a specific pattern of answers, if I would do the IQ test another time for another purpose, and if the two would be compared, then possibly the specific pattern of answers would be very similar, and that would allow the people comparing them to identify myself, to identify me as a subject. So we have different types of data. On the one hand, we have directly identifying personal data, indicated in red. Then we have indirectly identifiable personal data, which is indicated in gray. Then we have a whole bunch of research data, which is not identifying at all. On the one hand, it's easy to deal with it. On the other hand, it's also easy to deal with it. But it's this middle section that makes it difficult. So the directly identifying personal data, so the name, the address, the phone number, etc., that's easy. You just don't share it. At the Donors, we have a policy in place that requires us to delete this data within a specific time span after recording this data. That also means that this data must be stored in a format that allows for it to be deleted. So personal data should go in an Excel file or some other file where that file can be deleted. It cannot go in the file names of all your anatomical scans, because then it would be very difficult to delete. It cannot go in the directory names, etc. So it really has to go into a key file, and the key file is stored on a separate location. And the key file at a certain point is simply deleted, as easy as that. On the other hand, we have like a lot of research data which is not identifying. And that's also easy to deal with. But it's this middle section that's the hard part. And I know that a lot of data that we're acquiring in Childbrain, but also in Predictable, falls in this middle category. So the question is, how should we deal with this category of data that's possibly identifying? So that's where it's important to think about the different strategies that we have to limit possible identification. So it might be that you're recording data that is anonymous. And anonymous means that you never knew the subject's identity to start with. But it's very unlikely that you're recording that type of data, because usually we acquire data not on the street where you can just ask a random person that's walking by for his opinion, but we're actually inviting people to our lab. And at that moment, you already know who the person is. So we hardly ever record data that is anonymous. But what we can do is we can use a pseudonym. So if a subject comes in a lab, we're going to assign him a study-specific code, and we're going to use that code whenever we are referring to that subject. And that's something that of course, you should try to do as early as possible. Because if you use that subject's code in the file naming, then you don't have to remove the real name from the files later. So this is really about like sanity that you have to implement in your procedure, like use pseudonyms. The other important category, so this is about like whether you know the subject's name, yes or no. The other important part is about de-identification. And de-identification refers to things that you're doing to the data that you have recorded, not to the personal data, but to the biometric data. So de-identification, for example, removing indirectly identifying features. So if you take a photo, which you could see as like biometric data, like there's facial details on the photo, then blurring a photo is a way of de-identifying. It's removing the identifying features from the data. In the same way, you can also think about like removing the face from an anatomical MRI, or storing the age at the time of acquisition rather than the date of birth. Like the date of birth is identifying, the age of the time of acquisition is not really identifying. Like there are many people that have the same age, so it would be very difficult to identify someone by his age. If you're depending, of course, on the sample from so from on, depending on the population from which you're taking your sample, age might be identifying. So rather than using age, you might want to use age bins instead of years. In children, you might have to use very small age bins. Like if you're studying babies, your bins might have to be in months. But if you're studying elderly, your bins might have to be in years. And also, the identification might mean that you're going to store test outcomes rather than individual scores. The individual data point is not identifying. It's the combination of data that makes it identifiable. Like in the Netherlands, like most mothers at a certain point will give breastfeeding. So if you have a subject that has to give breastfeeding, well, you know it's a female. You know that it's a mother. But that's not, so that's basically like 5 million Dutch women. So not very identifying. But it's a combination of answers that makes it identifying. And that's why it sometimes is, in sharing data, it is needed that you share data that has been blurred. So whereas in your own research you might use the original data, in the data that you're sharing or in the data that you allow to be reused by others, you might have to remove identifying features or you might have to condense them such that individuals are not identifiable anymore. And this blurring, that's really situation specific. So if you think about like baby research, then you might want to blur the age into 1 month bins. Whereas if you're studying like people in a retirement home, it is pretty identifying if you happen to study this single woman who is like 115 years in the Netherlands. There's only one of her, right? So all of a sudden age is identifying, like age is uniquely identifying. Whereas if you split it in like age bins of 10 years, it's not identifying anymore. And the challenge with blurring is that it's specific for the situation. Like blurring is not only something that you do for a single data point. Well, of course, here I'm giving the example of a single data point, it's only age and blurring. But blurring is something that you have to consider in relation to all the data that you have collected from your subject. So that makes it difficult to say like how you should deal with this. Because it's your particular constellation of data that depends on how you should blur. But if you again think about this gradient between personal data and then indirect personal data and a lot of research data, then the strategy that you should plan for is, on the one hand, try to record as little as possible data that is really personal. If you don't need it, then don't record it. So if you're not going to use the date of birth, then why would you ask your subject? You can also just ask him, how old are you? And of course, here you have to consider pseudonymization. Like, don't use the subject's names in the files, but store the subject's names in a separate file that you can delete at a certain time. Then for a lot of this indirect personal data, you can use, on one hand, data minimization. Don't record it if you don't need it. But you can also use de-identifying and blurring strategies. And with those types of strategies, you can basically greenwash your otherwise gray data. And that makes it possible to share the data. And a lot of the data can be shared without concerns because that data is anonymous as soon as you have deleted your subject's identity. So one part of the data has to be kept safe and private, or has to be deleted at a certain point, like a certain well-defined point. Another part of the data has to be shared. But also in the sharing, you have to think about sharing responsibly and not simply throwing it on the internet. So sharing responsibly with legal constraints on reuse. And that is something that I want to explain a little bit more about. So as a researcher, you have a lot of contracts with various parties. So you have a contract with your funding agency. Or you could say, well, PAVO has the contract with the funding agency and you're just employed by the university. But you also have your contract with the ethics committee. The ethics committee has sent you a signed letter allowing you to do certain research. So that's a contract. And as soon as you invite subjects over in your lab or participants over in your lab, you inform them about the procedure and they sign the informed consent form. So that is a contract that you have with your participants. At a certain point, you're going to write your manuscript and you're going to submit it to a journal. At that moment, you're engaging in a contract with the publisher. And of course, in that contract, it might say that the publisher is going to get all the copyrights. Or in that moment, it might say that the copyrights remain with the author, and then we would say that it's open access. It's also important here, in terms of sharing data, is that you should think about the contract that you're going to sign with the recipient of the data upon sharing. And that's where the data use agreement comes in. The data use agreement is very similar to a copyright agreement, but copyright applies to text, and the data use agreement relates to data. So it's basically the data use agreement has to be aligned between, has to align the contract that you have with your research participants and the contract that you are going to make with the recipient of the data that you want to share with someone else. And I've got two examples. So let's first look at the Creative Commons Zero example. That is what, so Creative Commons was already mentioned earlier today, like it's I'm pretty sure you know what it is. There's different versions of the Creative Commons. This is also called the public domain dedication. And in Creative Commons Zero, the public domain dedication, you say, I'm not claiming copyrights. The person who associates the work with this deed, so you, has this, you decide that the work is owned by the public domain, and you waive all of his or her rights to the work worldwide under copyright law, etc., etc. And you basically say the recipient of the data can do with this data whatever he wants. And that might be fine if your participant agrees to that. But if it is potentially identifiable data, then probably the participant and probably the ethical committee have put some constraints in place that do not allow any attempts to identify the subject. Which means that you can do whatever you want with it, doesn't apply. So the Creative Commons Zero or the public domain dedication is not really a very good data use agreement for sharing data of potentially identifiable nature. So at the Donors we've been thinking, so in the Human Connectome project we've been thinking about this a lot. In the Human Connectome project we have we have three levels of data use agreements for the three different types of data. So we have data that is very easy to get your hands on. You just have to fill out your email address and you have to click that you agree to certain rules. And then there's data that requires the director of a research institute to sign. And then there's data that's even more sensitive and that requires an ethical, like an assessment by an ethical committee. And that data has to, for example, has to do with the with the drug abuse of the participants and other health information. So within the Donner Center, within the Donner Institute, we've been discussing data use agreements, like also looking at other examples. And this is the data use agreement that we use at the Donners for identifiable human data. I've highlighted a few of the important aspects. So the recipient of the data has to sign this contract. So the recipient complies with all the relevant rules and regulations. The recipient will not attempt to establish the identity of or attempt to contact of any of the included human subjects. And important, the recipient says, I will not link this data to any other database. So I would be perfectly fine with having my fingerprint shared under this data use agreement, because it would not be allowed to link the fingerprint to the database that the police might have on fingerprints. It also states, I will not redistribute. So it basically means that the University of Nijmegen, under which the Donners Institute falls, keeps the control over the data. So other people cannot redistribute, because if other people would redistribute, they might simply slap on another license, which of course is not something that we want. It also states, I will acknowledge that data came from the Donners Institute, and if I don't follow these rules, I'm not allowed to use the data anymore. So this is a difficult one. It basically puts the university in charge of determining whether the recipient of the data is behaving properly. And so far it hasn't happened. But of course, this is like we have examples right now. Facebook, Cambridge Analytics, where you all of a sudden where you realize, so this is what happens if you don't treat the data ethically. So Cambridge Analytics is simply, the company disappeared. Like it basically went like totally bankrupt. Facebook is having a difficult time. So right now companies are becoming aware of what happens if you don't treat data properly. And that's something that the university, also, like the University of Nijmegen, also really cares about. So that is also why, on top of the legal constraints, you also have to think about the other constraints which I had here, which are about the identifying blurring. So on the one hand, you should make it difficult to identify people. And on the other hand, you should make it forbidden to identify people. And both are needed. Okay. Yeah, just... Okay, so there's one more thing about... I think this is going to take another 10 minutes. Is that okay? Yeah? Okay. It's another thing which is about sharing publishing methods. Sharing and publishing methods, which is all like also in this middle section. So often you have much more details about your analysis than what fits in your methods section in your publication. And it's also not always possible to describe all those details in a human readable fashion. Like there's algorithmic details, and you simply can't describe that in words that a human can understand. A lot of the analysis nowadays are done using scripting, using computer programming languages such as MATLAB, Python, R, or SPSS. Also SPSS, if you can click, but you can also write your commands there, or Bash. And an analysis script corresponds to computer code. And that's why for open science, we can use the same types of version control systems that have been developed for source code. We can also use them for our scientific code. So I already mentioned Git. And GitHub, GitLab, and Bitbucket, which are websites that are based on Git. And what I want to show you is a little bit, like a very quick overview of how does version control work. And version control is something that you're all very familiar with already. Like if you have a manuscript that you're working on, you basically have version 1, version 2, version 3, etc. It might be that you're giving them names according to the date at which you've been working on it. At least that's something that I very often do. But it's very important that this works really well if there's like a sequential style of working, if you know that the later version is always the best one. In reality, that's not how things go. In reality, we have more of a tree-like organization where we have different versions. So if after version 1 and version 2, if you send it out to your co-authors, what you're doing is you're branching. You're creating different branches for the different versions. So one version is going to be changed by one co-author, you're going to change your version, and another co-author is going to make another version. And that's where merging is required to get the changes from the different co-authors again in one branch. And usually it's the first author of a manuscript that's responsible for sending out the version that gets branched, but also for merging it again. So this is a very common strategy that you're using for manuscripts. This is also what's happening for code. So if you're thinking about your analysis code, what you will very often have is a strategy where you have, like, you're developing something, and then all of a sudden you come up with multiple ideas. So you have idea A, idea B, and then you have something that, like, totally failed, so you're not going to pursue this idea. But at some point you realize, well, this is also not really working out, so let's continue along this line. So this is, like, in analysis, this is very often how people do their analysis. This is where it gets... So on the one hand, if you compare this to branching and merging, with manuscript, it's usually branching, sending it to multiple authors, and then merging the changes of multiple authors. Of course, if you have multiple versions yourself, if you're creating multiple versions yourself, you already have to merge your own versions. But it also becomes relevant if you start thinking about collaborating in the sense of sharing your code with other people. So if this is your copy on your computer, and what you can do is you can use a version control system such as GitHub to maintain such a versioned thing. So what you would have a similar copy of the same code on GitHub. And the way that GitHub works is that you can give other people access to that code. So someone else might make a copy, and someone else might actually start working on it. Yes, well, I'm making errors. So sometimes I'm updating something and I think, oh, this is actually not a good change.
Then it's occupying some space on your hard drive.
Space on hard drives is so cheap, I wouldn't bother. I would bother if it's data. Like, different versions of data are expensive. Different versions of code are not expensive.
Do you think it's useful to keep the whole code?
Yeah, I keep all my codes. Also because I don't have to think about it. Like, I know that I... And the good thing is, like, if I'm working in such a versioned manner, then every time that I make a version, I'm forced to type a very short comment on what I did. So I'm documenting the version. I think that's really helpful, because sometimes I'm writing... I will write down, like, very detailed, like, why I did a change. And sometimes I'm just typing down, like, I hope that this is going in the good in the right direction. If I then look back later at the comments that I wrote, I can see where it went wrong. So it's also about providing metadata in the same way as here. Sorry, here. This is also about metadata. It's the name of the author is already metadata. Like, you had, there's a lot of information related to that. Okay, so at a certain point, someone else might might get a copy of your code and might start working on it. And the nice thing about if you do version control is that you know where that person started working on, which means that you can take his suggested changes, you can copy them back to your copy on GitHub, you can copy them back to your version on the computer, and then eventually you might actually use the suggestions there to improve the thing that you think is working best. This is something that would be very difficult if you were not using version control, because there's multiple versions flying around, and if this person would not be using version control, you would not be able to get, like, to figure out where these changes, how they would work. Okay, so Git is, as a version control system, it's developed for the Linux kernel. It's developed by computer scientists. It has a lot of terminology that go with it, like repository, branches, commits, merges, clones, etc. And there's a lot of explanations. So this is something that takes you some time to figure out, like, how does Git work? It took me some time as well, but it's well worth it. I'm not going to explain that here. There's some really good online resources. Like, there's an online Git book, and Coursera has a really interesting course on using Git. I think it's really worthwhile studying. So, let me come to the unicorns. Open science, like I explained version control for your code. So, science is work. Science is not some magical fix. If you're doing something, you might not necessarily get the perfect answer at the first try. So, I would say, well, some of these unicorns that you've been drawing before the lecture are actually quite close to being able to publish, but, like, this one needs some work. I don't know. So it's anonymous. I don't know who drew it, but, like, this was like the Rockstar unicorn or so. This one is interesting, but I might need a little bit more explanation as well. This looks like a dinosaur, if you ask me. So if you do science, it's not directly perfect at the first attempt, but that's not a reason not to share, right? So the idea is that you need in your progress of work, you need multiple versions or editions or releases. And if something really fails, well, then you retract it. You basically say, this is not something that I want to publish anymore. But also, if you improve it, that gives you an opportunity to actually make a new revision. And that's something that has been around for a long time. We've had books, like, and books have editions, and editions of books, they basically change over years, sometimes over a decade, and then a new edition comes out. Of course, we also have revision control of software, and software changes like more at the pace of like once a year, or nowadays like once a month, or sometimes even once a week. Like apps get more and more easy to install, so it's also changing more rapidly. And I think it's really important to understand, like, although, so in a way that we do science, like, it doesn't have to be perfect. Scientific evidence stays constant. So I'm not saying that we should withdraw scientific evidence, but what is changing is the way that we interpret this scientific evidence. And something that sounded like a good plan or a good explanation of the data at a certain point might at a later point turn out to be like a false alarm. Or there might be something in your data that you overlooked at the first instance. That is really important to report. Okay, so a last few more slides. So I've tried to explain like that open science is about like making what's the relevance of open science, but also what are the skills needed for open science. And on the one hand, we have motivations, like making research more reproducible, increasing the chance to reproduce and replicate, and also to facilitate collaboration. I have personally not really touched upon like publications or open access articles, books, like massive online courses, etc. But I think you all know about them. What I've been trying to do is give you a little bit of feel of like what are the tools that we use in open science. And some of these tools are not necessarily designed for science, such as Google Docs or Skype or Git. But they're still very valuable for science. And open data is really important for open science. And open source, I think, is really important for open science. I've got one more question for you. So if you can get your phones out once more. That's this one. So do you have open science on your resume? I'm pretty sure that most of you have already started thinking about a resume, like on your CV, like thinking about your next job, your PhD, or it's like your first postdoc contract. So it only mentions your driver's license. It mentions that you have publications, shared presentations, shared code, or shared data. Or does it also mention your open science skills? So a lot of you are putting publications in there, and I think it makes a lot of sense. But if I recall correctly, you can give multiple answers here. But also a lot of you are putting open science skills in here. I think that's really a relevant thing to consider as well. So if we just consider, like, why is open science relevant for you? As a researcher, you are at this moment already using open science resources, which have been built by people just like you, just like me, by scientists. But as a researcher, you also contribute to those resources by sharing your own research results, like in open access, but also the more detailed parts from not only the primary findings, but also more detailed parts about your results and your methods and your results section. And, of course, your career opportunities, they will depend on your output, like what you've achieved. And they're going to depend not only on what you're going to write in your resume, but they're also going to depend on what the person who's going to read your resume is able to find about you. If I'm hiring someone, I will always type the name into Google, see what I'm going to find. It's not about the Facebook page, but it's about, like, how has this person contributed to the things that I care about? I care about open science. I care about using new research methodologies. So if someone writes that he's a good MATLAB programmer, I want to see his MATLAB code. If someone claims that he can write good English, I want to read an English paper. If someone says that he's good in societal impact and public outreach, I want to see a blog post in which he explains something to the general audience. So in that way, open science, the things that we're doing for open science are relevant for your career in science, but are also relevant for your career outside of science, because a lot of these things are also valuable for outside of science. So you can access these open science tools, but you also have benefit from these open science skills, either in the future or in a future academic, but also in a future non-academic job. And I think that open science, as a way of transitioning from into new styles of doing research, is a transferable skill. And rather than like the old-fashioned style of doing like research in a library, sit there for long times, not be disturbed by anyone, like open science is really about using the new methodology of computers, and that's where it's where you basically you can use the new technology that has been provided. And you just have to remember that the things that you're making, they don't really have to be perfect at the first attempt. That's also part of open science, is that we're sensitive to different versions, different attempts. And very important is that you're like along the way that you're showing that you learn. That's why version control is important. Because if you can show that this is my first version, this is how I've improved myself, that's actually something that also your future employer is going to look at. Like how can you improve yourself and how can you become even a more important asset. I've put some additional reading material online about open science, and I've also put this presentation online. So if you go to this QR code, you can browse this presentation once more. I will just leave it up here for a little bit longer. Okay, thanks for your attention.